during Haggadah?
The Haggadah, as we know it, is cobbled together by a lot of different authors in the days of Chazal. And all that cobbling... What? Okay, all that cobbling produced a very interesting literary effect. What's the literary effect? With so much excitement, everyone had something to say, that the authors of the Haggadah created this very, very extensive stylistic introduction, partly based on the Gemara, to create changes and diversions to get everyone excited, partially just to set the tone, to try to incorporate all the shittas in the Gemara. So this really, really long introduction for the story. The story is what happened that night, how we left, how we were enslaved. And that story begins with Tzei Olamad. And I'll describe that in a moment. Everything before Tzei Olamad is just icing. It's just getting us in the mood. So we eat karpas so that the kids get all like, what's going on? And we eat karpas, what's going on? So they start asking questions. When we break the matzah, that's odd. Let's ask some questions. And then we invite people into our house because that's... sit down. Because that's what people do in Yom Tov and Halach Manya. And then, of course, we paraphrase the Mishnah and the four questions. Then we give like a short answer just to respond to the questions. And we talk about a machlokas tanayim about whether you should mention Mitzrayim during the night or not. And about five rabbis who spent so much time discussing Yetzias Mitzrayim that day broke and they had to be reminded by their Talmidim. And then, literally, there are four different types of children because there are four sections in the Torah that encourage us to discuss the story. And Chazal associated them with different types of children and types of conversations. And we haven't yet started talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim. This is all one long Hineni Muchan Mizuman. Instead of saying Hineni Muchan Mizuman, talk about Rabbanim who spoke about Yetzias Mitzrayim. Talk about Machlokes about when you speak about Yetzias Mitzrayim. Four generic questions. Everyone knows what those questions are. They don't help us drill down into Mitzrayim. Little kids say them. This is all effect. The real story begins with the section we know as Tzei Olamad. But what happens? What happens in all of your seders? You get so excited. And you have so many notebooks. And all the kids and grandkids are there. And we spend 30 minutes discussing the gematria of karpas. And 20 minutes talking about why halach mani. My seder also. Not me. 20 minutes on why halach mani was written in Aramaic. Everyone says the four questions. Everyone has to. And then we sing about the mayinu. And then 4 hours on why the five rabbis went B'nai Brak. And was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's beard white? Or was it black? And who are the four kids? And every year I dread them. I the chacham with the rusher. That's, I don't know. I'm going crazy. And then it's 10 o'clock, 10:15. Mom's rolling her eyes. I work like a slave. I clean the grout between the tiles. I make delicious food. And you guys are getting my soup and chicken all cold. So mom's rolling her eyes. Dad's freaking out. So what happens? Or granddad? Okay, everyone. Let's quickly say the Haggadah and say it like Tehillim. So we'll get to Dayenu and sing Dayenu and say Kol Shlomar. And you know what happens? You skip it. You skip Tzipor Yetzias Mitzrayim. Because talking about Elazar ben Azariah's beard, or Machlokas, whether you should say Yetzias Mitzrayim at night, or simple little questions like Avadim Hayinu, Avadim Hayinu, Hayinu, just doesn't cut it. And it's really unfortunate, and it's a great unfortunate circumstance because everyone is well-meaning. This is the excitement of Pesach takes over. The core of the Haggadah, the meat of the Haggadah, is the section known as Tzei Olamad. That doesn't mean you should go back and tell your dad, okay, we're starting from Tzei Olamad. That's what I'm going to do one day when I run the Seder, Baruch Hashem. I've never run a Seder because my parents are both alive and I defer to them. But one day, if I ever get to run a Seder, let's hurry up and get to Tzipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Everything is just like a nice way of getting us in the mood. What is Tzei Olamad? Why should you study it? And we'll study one part of it today. Tzei Olamad takes a four-pasuk synopsis of Yetzias Mitzrayim from Parshas Kisavo. In Parshas Kisavo, the person brings Bikurim, that's the scene, the context, and he recites, or she recites, a four-pasuk synopsis. Pasuk number one, dissent. Arami Ovid Avi, Vayered Mitzvaymar, Ishan Lagagadol, Atzum Barai. How we descended into Egypt. Second pasuk of the synopsis, enslavement. Vayareo Tanah Mitzvim Vayanunu, Vayetnu Lein Avodah Kasha. Third pasuk of the synopsis, prayer. Vanitzak al Hashem, Vayishma Hashem et Koleinu, Vayar et Anyenu, Vetam Aleinu, Vetlachatzeinu, Hashem, listen to our tefillos. This is all the beginning of your sheet. I'll share it digitally later because this is really important for the Seder. Fourth pasuk of the synopsis is redemption. Pasuk number one, descent. Pasuk number two, bondage. Pasuk number three, prayer. Pasuk number four, geula. Now the Haggadah deconstructs each of those pasukim. What does this term in Kitavo mean? Well, how will I know what this term in Kitavo means? Let me parallel this term in Kitavo with a similar or identical term somewhere else in Tanakh, more often from Va'er and Bo, which describe its Yes Mitzrayim. And if in Va'er and Bo the term means so-and-so, so in Kitavo it also means so-and-so. Not always, we go up so from Divrei Hayamim, from Yoel. But we're taking this four pasuk section, deconstructing it into little components, saying, oh, what does this word mean? What does it tell us about Yitzias Mitzrayim? How do we know what this word means? Let's find another place in Va'era or Bo, not in Kitavo, or maybe anywhere else in Tanakh where that same term from Kitavo is used. And what does it mean there? It probably means the same thing in Kitavo. So there are about, on average, seven components to each pasuk, four psukim, so about 28 components. So there are 28 drashas in the Haggadah about Yitzias Mitzrayim. And those 28 components contain the story that Chazal want us to discuss. And they incorporate into the Haggadah. And again, it's just so painful because how much time are you going to spend? I don't like to use the word narishkeit. It's not narishkeit, it's a Haggadah, but it's not meant. Again, it's a beautiful problem because we get so excited and there's so much enthusiasm, but just you have to get to the Haggadah. Sometimes fine, like no one's talking about Yitzias Mitzrayim because they're so busy talking around the issue rather than speaking about the issue. So today I just want to discuss one of the four psukim, in part to help you understand how we left Mitzrayim, in part to encourage you when you spend your time studying the Haggadah, at the very least, even if your Seder doesn't follow that pattern, skip, just open up the Seder Lamad and spend all your time there, because that's where the story emerges. Okay, so let's describe the fourth pasuk, and we'll follow the trail of the Haggadah. We'll try to tease out some of the aspects of Yitzias Mitzrayim. Here's the pasuk again. The fourth pasuk is Geula. V'yetzeinu Hashem Elokeinu Misham. There are five modifiers to this pasuk. Look at the pasuk. Biyad Chazaka, Zorah Netriya, Marah Gadol, Osos, and Mosin. The Haggadah is going to tease out meanings through Midrashim, through Psukim that refer to Midrashim, about these four terms. Let's follow the Haggadah. The first part is Biyad Chazaka. What does the Haggadah interpret Yad Chazaka to be? Zoha Dever. You say it every year, but you say it like Tehillim, so you never stop and think, what are you saying? Why in the world would Yad Chazaka and Ki Sabo be referring to Dever? If I asked you, Paul, what would you say is the Yad Chazaka, the Makkah? Come on, what would you say is the Makkah that represents Yad Chazaka? Anyone? Becharos. Great. Second, family feud. Second answer on the board. What?
Barad.
Third answer on the board. Choshech. Great. Fourth answer on the board. Whatever. We could keep going. Dever is not making the top five. I don't think anyone here is thinking Dever is Yad Chazaka. So what in the world does this Medrash mean? It's a Medrash. And why is that God quoting it? So part of the answer to that question is to reimagine what makot are. Makot are not just punitive measures to punish the Egyptians for their abuse, to break the will of the Egyptians. Makot are also meant to introduce Hashem to religious consciousness. Mitzrayim happens 2,448 years into history. Humanity has been lost in idolatry and paganism. And Hashem, through the various makos, and I'm not going to go into the various makos now, is introducing the basic terms of monotheism. And that's why pay attention when you read the makos to the three makos that have a theological warning prefacing them. Dam, Keni Hashem, Arov, Keni Hashem Bekerav Haaretz, and Barad, Ki En Kamoni B'chol Haaretz. And what are the differences between those terms? And those are the three makos that are most directly theological, because they have a theological preface. Ki ani Hashem, Dam, Ki ani Hashem mekerev aretz, Arov, Ki ein kamoni b'chol aretz, makas varei. One of the basic themes of monotheism is that Hashem doesn't have any physical image or any physical body parts. Nothing about our lives and our physical experiences can compare to Hashem's essence. None of the words we have that are culled from human experience apply to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, when the Makkah of Dever was introduced to the Egyptians by Moshe, how did Moshe warn them? Let's look at the pasuk. Why is Yad Chasakah called Dever? Because in Parshas Va'era, when Moshe warns the Egyptians about Dever, what does he say? Hine Yad Hashem Hoya b'miknecha asher basadeh. Basasim b'chamarim b'gmalim b'bakar v'atzon Dever kaved mi'od. If you're an Egyptian, and you hear Yad Hashem Hoya b'miknecha, in your mind, gods are physical. You're an idolist. You're an idolater. In your mind, gods are just stronger, larger versions of human beings. So when the warning comes, Hine Yad Hashem Hoya b'miknecha, what are you imagining? Everyone look at me. A really big hand descending from heaven, lifting up cattle like a minion. Because in your mind, that's what God, I got a pretty big hand, guys. A big hand coming down from heaven, lifting up cattle one by one to heaven. Because that's how you imagine your gods. What did they see? Dever, and I'm going to take this comment back in a few minutes, is the only invisible makom. I know there's one other, but we'll get to that later. Every other makkah had a physical reference. Water, the blood, frogs, crocodiles, maybe we'll talk about whether they're frogs or crocodiles, vermin, kinin, even darkness, the pasuk says, was palpable, via meshchoshech. They could actually feel it and see it. Dever is invisible. So Hashem is debunking their faulty view of God. You think you will see my hand, because you think I have a hand. And you will see nothing. And you will realize that I am invisible and unknowable, and there's an invisible world that I inhabit, so to speak, not inhabit an invisible world that human eyes can't trace. That's why the phrase in Ki Tavo, Yad Chazakah, means Dever, not because it was strong and imposing and pulverizing and impressive and intimidating, because it was almost taunting the Egyptians into believing God or envisioning God in their set of reference points and then debunking that and saying, I'm not visible. And the process already started with Kinim, two before Dever. What did the Egyptian magicians respond? How did they respond to Kinim? What did they call it? Etzbalukim, because it was not something physical and it was very small and therefore was irreproducible. Paganism was merged with black magic. Black magic was a field that was joined at the hip with paganism. Jesus was a black magician. He was able to solidify water. He was able to, not only him. And part of the movement to monotheism is moving away from the world of black magic. Black magic excelled at material conversion. You can convert water to solid. You can convert blood to water, water to blood. You can summon frogs, reptiles from the Nile. But once material started to shrink in Kenan, it was harder. And Rashi says this, She'en ha'she'i t'shar b'pachas mikizayas. Rashi fills us in on the inability. These are all, I'm quoting for you from the sources I gave you. Rashi is describing to us that as we move from Dam and Tzvardeh, which the Egyptian magicians, pagan magicians, could reproduce and simulate, now things were becoming smaller, not yet invisible, and the Egyptians are realizing HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in their own mind, he's not large and materialistic, as we, not materialistic, but hedonistic, but he's not based on material. Etzbe Elokim is not something you can see and touch and feel. It's very small and minuscule. And then when it came to Dever, they were told, Yad Hashem Hayev Miknecha, and you won't see anything. Now, I lied to you before because I told you that Dever was the only invisible Makkah. What other Makkah was invisible, of course? Makkah's Bacharos. Now, in truth, the term Yad Chazakah appears twice because this lesson was delivered twice. The word Yad Chazakah as a reference to Hashem appears once in Ki Tavo, and where else? After Ki Tavo. I'm giving you a little hint. That's a pretty big hint. Where else does the term Yad Chazakah appear after Ki Tavo? Ulachal, last pasuk in the Torah. Ulachal, Hayada Chazaka, Ulachal, Hamara Gadol, Asha Asa Hashem, Leinei Kol Yisrael. That's the last pasuk. I quoted for you here in source number Gimel. And that iteration of the term Yad Chazaka, Chazal interpret, look at source number Dalet, they interpret that reference to Yad Chazaka to Makat Bechoret. Namely, Makat Bechoret was Dever part two. We've seen that when a virus breaks out in the animal kingdom, it pretty quickly spreads to the human realm. It was apparent to everyone that they were expected to die during Dever. There's no reason the human shouldn't die during Dever. Hashem preserved the human beings during Dever to afford Paro with a chance to perform tshuva. And when he didn't, the second part of Dever occurred. And there are multiple crosslinks between Makat Bechoret and Dever. None more obvious than the 5-10 symmetry. There are 10, the 5th is Dever, the 10th is Makat Bechoret. And they're both called by Chazal, Yad Chazaka, because they're each invisible deaths. And Makat Bechoret is the death that should have happened during Dever, but was forestalled by Hashem so that they could perform Tshuva or not. So Makat Bechoret was the Negev, was the Magifa of Dever. So when we say every year, Vayotzeinu Hashem Elokeinu Misham biyad chazaka zo hadever, we mean, not because it's so overwhelming, but Yad Chazaka was Hashem's method of teaching them, my hand is invisible. And that was most apparent during Dever. That's why Chazal say Dever was not just a one-off event, but Dever was actually a backdrop to every single Makkah. The Medrash says that Dever was like the background music of every single Makkah, because the background music is, I'm not visible. Even though there are visible material events that are taking place, I'm not visible and you can't see me. Okay, that's just one phrase of the last pasuk. Let's move on to the second phrase. What's the second phrase of the pasuk? How does the Haggadah interpret Zerah Netriah? Again, we say it every year, but we're so busy and so rushed that we're not thinking. Zerah Netriah zu hacherev. What in the world does cherev mean? I know the makot. I'm old enough to remember the makot. There's only one chet, and it's choshech. There is no makot called cherev. What does cherev mean? Why are Chazal interpreting that we were redeemed through a cherev? Where's the cherev? I've read Ve'er and Bo over 50 times in my life. More than that. I've never seen the word cherev appear in Ve'er and Bo. Now, how do Chazal know that the word Zra Netriya means cherev? Right, because there's a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim where David sees a heavenly apparition, and that heavenly apparition is threatening Yerushalayim, and the threat to Yerushalayim because of the David HaMelech's mistake of counting the Jewish people. So that heavenly apparition has an outstretched arm, Zerah Netriah, and that outstretched arm is clasping a cherev. So we recite the pasuk in Divrei Hayamim, source number two. Zerah Netriah, this is all taken from the Haggadah. I filled in the whole pasuk. Shenema, v'isa David et enav. They start fasting to repeal the Gezerah. What in the world is Cherev? What is a Cherev? So here's the answer. There are two answers, and each is supremely important. Number one, don't get trapped by Rabbi Huda. What do you mean, don't get trapped by Rabbi Huda? There are 10 makot, and there are literally hundreds of ways to combine them and hundreds of different permutations between the makot. One of them is 3-3-4, the tzachadash biachav. And we recite them because maybe they're on the staff, on the mata. But there are hundreds of other ways to combine makos, groups of two, groups of four, groups of three. Those mathematicians here can imagine how many possible combinations and permutations there are to 10 makos, especially if you allow the permutations not to be in groups of 3, 3, and 4s. One of the ways to imagine the sequence of Makot is a group of 10, or at least a group of 7. What does a group of 7 mean? So I'm going to paraphrase this Medrash for you. It's a very well-known Medrash. Rashi actually quotes it, but you can, of course, read it. According to the Medrash, the 10 Makos were organized in a strategy which resembled ancient warfare. How would ancient people wage war? If you send in your troops too early, you'll suffer inordinate Russian-like casualties. You'll lose hundreds of thousands of soldiers. So what you need to do is you need to soften the enemy. How do you soften the enemy? Well, in most cases, you're laying siege to a fortress city. So you encircle the city, and the first thing you do is you cut off the water supply. Water and food, now people are hungry, there's no water, and you've weakened your enemy. The next stage is to discombobulate and disorient them by not letting them sleep. Well, how do you take away their sleep habits? You constantly make loud noises. Go back to all the movies you wasted your time watching in high school, and you remember all the war scenes with the huge, I evidently saw them also once, with the huge bullhorn. All day and all night, and the shields clasping against each other, and the spears hitting the ground. And no one has a routine, no one's sleeping because it's full of noise. Then you send in the archers. Archers were extremely valuable in ancient war, obviously, because you could attack your enemy from a distance. Does anyone in this room know the origin of the middle finger? Because I told you, because you know. Right. The origin of the middle finger, for people who I didn't tell this to, it was never meant as a curse. In ancient warfare, if you wanted to exchange prisoners of war, you want to disable them before you return them. You don't want them to come back and fight. You're willing to let them go back to get your own soldiers back, but you don't want them to then defeat you on the battlefield. Now, if you want to disable someone from shooting a gun, you cut off their index finger. You can't pull the trigger. That's what you used to do in Brooklyn. Kneecap them. Fall off their index finger. If you want to disable an archer, you don't pull off their index finger, you pull off their middle finger. Because then you can't create tension. You can't create sufficient tension on the arrow to shoot it with enough velocity. So imagine pulling a really long bow without a middle finger. It's almost impossible. Without a middle finger, you can't. The tension is created by pinching your middle finger to your thumb and pulling. So you would disable archers before exchanging prisoners by cutting off the middle finger. Now, before every ancient war, as you've seen in the movies, you would try to psych out the other side by screaming and cursing, and we're going to get you, and holding up your shields, and Braveheart style. How would you psych out the other side? You'd scream and shout, and then you'd call all your archers to the front of the row to show how many archers you have and frighten the other side. How would you show that you have that many archers? So all the archers would hold up their middle finger. We're archers, we're archers, we're archers. And the other side would see how many middle fingers were raised, and they'd be frightened or demoralized. So the middle finger is never meant to be a curse. It was meant to be a sign that you're an archer. The next time someone flips you the bird, just say, "Oh, you must be Robin Hood." Don't recommend that. If they're angry, they'll probably get them more furious. "Oh, you're Robin Hood. What did you just say?" And then it will go pretty. One day I'll tell you a story when I said that to someone who flipped me the bird. I almost didn't escape with my life in Canarsie. Let's just put it that way. Someone flipped me the bird, and I went quick with my tongue, and let's just say I almost died that Saturday night. But I live to tell the story, so it's all good. It doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. And in any event, so you send in the archers. And again, archers doesn't mean a few arrows shot here and shot there, but imagine 2,000 arrows being shot at once. Imagine the sun being blinded by arrows. Imagine arrows piercing people, crushing their skulls, pinning them to walls. Now, you're not going to conquer the city through archery, but again, you'll kill hundreds of people. You'll sow panic and fear. So now they're at the stage where they're not sleeping, they're not eating or drinking, they're burying their dead from the air invasion. And then what you do is you unleash the freaks. Every ancient army had freaks. Who are the freaks? Giants, crazy, crazy, animalistic, barbaric. Freaks can't be part of an army. An army thrives on discipline, thrives on uniformity, thrives on following the rules. But you always have the freaks. And the freaks are running through town, bashing in heads, spiking people with their spike balls, raping women, terrorized. At some point, the army's going to vanquish the freaks, because that's what just happens. Freaks don't have no control. So, but again, you're frightening the heck out of the people. Who knows where it's coming from? And then you're ready to start thinking about the attack, and how do you attack? You bring in the ramparts, you bring in the catapults, and you start throwing fiery boulders into town to pulverize the gates, to break down the ramparts, to light the city on fire with these fiery boulders. And then once that's finished, then you send in the infantry. If you send in the infantry early, they're going to suffer too many casualties. If you wait till you soften people up and weaken them, less casualties. The matter says that's exactly how HaKadosh Baruch Hu crafted the Makos. First, he cut off the water supply. Done. Not just the water supply, but the food supply, because Egyptians don't eat bovine meat. So what is their only source of protein? Fish. And the Torah takes its attention, takes care to tell us the fish in the Nile died because the Nile turned into blood. The next stage was loud noises. Now, Tzfardea was a multifaceted event. I'm not going to go into all the details, but part of it was a sound. None of these makos were one-dimensional. They're all multi-layered. Open your mind. Don't lazily slip into what you learned about them in second grade. Try to read and think. These are all HaKadosh Baruch Hu crafting tapestries of events, multi-layers, theological, punitive, moral, reviving Jewish. There's too much happening to just be, oh, this is what happened to the Egyptians. So part of that, not the only part, was the sound. Not a few frogs, right? They still have frogs in the pond. In the summer, a couple of frogs in the pond, you'll hear them croaking. You imagine multiplying, scaling three or four frogs you hear croaking to 3 million. You don't sleep at night. All it is endless. All night long. Like someone snoring right in your ear. All night long. Then you send in the archers. Now, Chazal, in my opinion, this is the biggest stretch. They see kinim as archery. Again, the kinim are not lice. Lazy definition. That's what kinim means in modern Hebrew. Kinim is a vermin. Write this down. Vermin infestation. They were attacked by swarms of vermin. Rats, mice, cockroaches, bugs, insects. Anything that creeps, creeping, crawling. It was a creepy, crawling invasion. One, there's a couple of lice, and they have to go get head and shoulders and get better shampoo. Then Hashem sends in the freaks, and the freaks are Arav. Remember, what made Arav so freaky is that the predatory patterns were different. Normally, animals are very, very pedantic about territorial predation. Namely, they've got their territories, they urinate to signal their territories, and if you're down, you don't want to enter the territory of a bear. And if you're a bear, you're not going to make it out with your life in your life. And all of a sudden, there were bears and lions and snakes predating side by side. That's why it's called Arov, a mixture, Tarovis. Not called Chaios, it's called Arov. Now, why was it a mixture? It's a whole different story, but it freaked them out because it was against a natural pattern. Egyptians were scientists. Egyptians knew their surroundings. This was an aberration. They didn't know what to expect. If the lions had attack, okay, there's something happening with the lions. We'll quell it. All of a sudden, they're literally going out of their minds. And then Hashem sends in the Barad / Shechin, fire / boulders. And then once this is finished, Hashem sends in the infantry. The infantry is the Arba, because there's nothing that symbolizes soldiers more than uniform swarms of locusts, all seeming to fly in unison. That's why it's called Arba, from the word Harbe, the play on words Arba and Harbe. And that's why when Yoel describes the invasion of Eretz Yisrael, the metaphor for the invasion of Eretz Yisrael, for my army that I will send into Eretz Yisrael, the metaphor that happened is the Arba of Yoel, which is the Arba, the second event of Arba in Tanakh. Now the question is why? Why are the Makos structured like war, metaphorically? Well, what's the answer? Why should the Mako resemble war? Why is this important? What? There was war, but why do the Egyptians? Doesn't make a difference whether it looks like war, but it makes a difference to whom? It may make a difference to us. Because what was the original plan? We leave Mitzrayim in Nisan. We receive the Torah in Sivan. And what happens around Elul time? Before we rerouted history. Before Teaneck in Los Angeles and Siberia and South Africa, what was the original plan? We basically arrive in Israel in the summertime, and we have to go to war with 30 warlords in Canaan. And it isn't easy for slaves who've been demoralized, spat upon, raped, ridiculed, to fight in battle. Rav Amital told us that one of the great miracles of 48 was much of the battle was waged by Holocaust survivors who had seen their families murdered and were horrified and traumatized, and yet they had to defend our country against the Arab invasion. Hashem himself knew the delicacy of the human psyche. That's why he didn't want to take the Jews up the western coast to face the armies of Plishtim. So we rerouted. Well, Nachum Lakim Derech Eretz Plishtim. So we can only fight those wars in 3-4 weeks or months if we have confidence that Hashem knows how to wage war. So Hashem is addressing this not just to the Egyptians. He's addressing this to the Jewish people. I know war. I get the concept. I know how to wage war. When you meet these fortress cities in Canaan, just know I know what I'm doing. And I showed you that I know what I'm doing in Mitzrayim when I structured the Makot like war. And then the metaphoric war in Mitzrayim became an actual war when? When did we see that Hashem knows not just in theory how to wage war, and he can choreograph the Makot to resemble more in theory? Tell me, Hashem, how do you wage war? But Hashem actually goes to war for us.
Hashem ish milchama.
At the Yamsuf. Hashem ish milchama, Hashem shemo. There are steeds and chariots and swords. And it's important for us to know that Hashem is ish milchama, because we're going to have that confidence. So, when we say every year, we are referring to this medrash. That Hashem redeemed us from Egypt in a year-long process that looked like war and resembled war. The cherev is metaphoric. There's no cherev. There's no makot called cherev. All the makot look like cherev. Second reason we say cherev is, in truth, it was an actual war. And it broke out that night in Mitzrayim. What happened that night of Yetzias Mitzrayim? Who knows? The Bechorot convened on Paro's home and said, enough. Everything this man has said is coming true. We're now in the crosshairs. Let these Fashtunken Jews get out of the country before we die. And the horrific part of hatred is that it is psychopathic. And when you hate someone so much, you know it, right? You do things which are self-destructive, and especially when you hate Jews. There are stories of German soldiers waiting on platforms to either go to Stalingrad to reinforce the suffering German ranks, or to go to Normandy and reinforce the Germans who were fighting a two-front war, but they were stalled on the platforms watching trains pass by carrying Jews to be murdered in Auschwitz. Who knows, had Hitler not been so psychopathic, if he may have triumphed in World War II. Imagine all the resources he dedicated to murdering Jews. Had those resources been repurposed to his two-front war, who knows how World War II would have ended differently. But you're just so hateful that you act in ways that are self-destructive. Rabbi Soloveitchik talked about this around the Ovid Avi. Who was Lavan out to get? His own children, his own daughters and grandchildren. Paro was the same. He hated Jews so viciously that he's even willing to sacrifice his own firstborn. As it happened, Mibachar Paro Hoshev Akiso, his firstborn, didn't make it out alive that night. But beforehand, the Bechoros are gathering in Tiananmen Square. That's China. What's it called? Carrier Square? What's the square in Egypt? Where all those protests took place about 8 years ago? Not Tiananmen Square. There's a square. Tahrir Square or something. There is a square. Obviously, it's not the same square. What? Tahrir Square. Right? There's a square. They're gathering in the square, and they're saying, we won't take this. And Paro is recalcitrant. And, according to the Medrash, a civil war breaks out. And 60,000 Egyptians lose their life in this civil war. And now I'm going to say something that I don't mean because I'm going to take it back. And then after the civil war, Makas Bacharos breaks out at midnight. And the reason I'm going to reject that is because Makas Bacharos is a two-staged event. First, a domestic civil war breaks out, which looks like it is completely internal, but it helps us realize that Hashem doesn't just intervene in nature, and doesn't just intervene in science, doesn't just intervene in psychology, but he also intervenes in politics. And what seems to be an eternal Egyptian scuffle is really Hashem manipulating the Egyptians into civil war. And then at midnight, the second part of Makas Bacharos shifts, where the instruments of the first part become the victims of the second part. The Bacharos, who are the instruments of Makas Bacharos from 6 to 12, become the victims of Makas Bacharos from 12 to 6. And that's why in Halal HaGadol, when we summarize Yetzias Mitzrayim, we recite L'makei Mitzrayim You know, can you finish the Makim Mitzrayim? Bivichorehem. This is a medrash. Through their bechoras, not lemaki bechoras Mitzrayim. Lemaki Mitzrayim bivchorehem. Probably one of the most important lessons tonight, guys. Politics is a veil. Hashem works through politics also. It's just harder to see because it looks like it's human crafted. Hashem works through politics as well. It's hard to determine how. That's why Hashem forced. Why did Hashem just take us out of Mitzrayim? Why does he have to break Paro's will? Because he wants to work through human politics to demonstrate that he can redeem our people by coursing his redemption through politics. So the second reason we say Zohar Cherev is not just there was a Makos organized metaphorically as a war, but there was an actual war. Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim by launching an internal Egyptian war that was still part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's intervention. Okay, take a breath. We've just discussed 40% of 25%. One pasuk is 25% of Arami Ovidabi. We've discussed 40% of the pasuk, 2 out of 5. Could you imagine how much is out there and how much you're losing by investing in karpas or investing in yachas? This is the mitzvah. What happened? How did we leave Mitzrayim? What was Deborah? What was the message of that? What happened the night of Bacharos? What's the Charev? What's the... Let's move on. Part number 3. This is probably, to me, the most important part of Pesach. Vayotzeinu Hashem Elokeinu Misham biyad chazaka uvizra netriya uvimara gadol. What does the Haggadah interpret Mara Gadol to be? Gila Shechina. Why is Mara Gadol Gila Shechina? Because there's a pasuk in Bet Hanan that has the word Mara Gadol right next to something which refers to Gila Shechina. Again, this is the methodology of the Haggadah, to find the phrase somewhere else in Tanakh and to borrow the meaning from that phrase, extrapolate the meaning. So let's read the Haggadah together. Over Mara Gadol, Zu Gila Shechina. Shenemar Ohanisa Lagim Lavalakachs Lagami Garav Goy Be'al Masos Be'al Taltav Motim Lechalech Hatzak of Zayin Tiriyah Over Maraim Gedolim. There's our phrase. Kachol Asher Asal Lechem Hashem Elokichem Mitzrayim Leinech. Okay, this is an extremely important part of Pesach, both the concept and the words. So please listen carefully. It's really important that you guys get this down. The night of Pesach was a night of punishment. Was a night of breaking the will of egotistical tyrants. Was a night of liberty, political liberty. Was a night, but it was also the night of romance, where Hashem took us as His bride. My minhag is, at 2 a.m, when everyone's exhausted. Does anyone have this minhag at home? Everyone's fallen asleep, drunk with 4 or 5 cups of wine, making a beeline for their beds. And everyone knows that Uncle Mesh, okay, it's time for Shir HaShir. And everyone gathers together, we sing Shir HaShir. And that was Rav Lichtenstein's minhag. This is the night of Shir HaShir. This is the night of our love with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's why we recite Shir HaShir on Pesach. This is the night Hashem took us as His bride. And the event that best demonstrated Hashem's love for us, and we'll read this in a moment, is the first mass revelation. Did not happen in Har Sinai. Did not happen in the Beis HaMikdash. The first trick question. The first mass revelation happened in the stinking, bloody, vulgar, shrine-laden, corpse-filled, rotting streets of Mitzrayim. A place that Moshe couldn't daven. A sewer. Feces all over the place. Bodies strewn. Dead bodies. It reeked. Amr of Shimon, first source. Gedola chibasan shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem loves us so much. Guys, one day, hopefully, you'll all fall in love. Very often boys come to me, how do I know I'm in love? So my first answer is, let me look at your eyes. If your eyes aren't red, you're not in love. What do you mean? I make my eyes red? No, no. If you're in love, you can't go to sleep. You just want to spend all night talking. 2 o'clock becomes 3 o'clock. 3 o'clock becomes 4 o'clock and can't get enough sleep. If your eyes aren't red, come back to me. Okay, what if I don't see the eyes? Are you having problems having Kavan and Shmon Esrei? If you're not having problems with Kavan and Shmon Esrei, you're not in love. Okay. Well, I have problems now having Kavan and Shmon Esrei. That's not a test. Okay, next test, are you in love? When you're in love, you don't care where you are. You could be in a museum in a beautiful landscape in a beautiful mountain, or you could be sitting in some tenement somewhere. You don't care. Place is based on the person you want to be with, and you don't care where you are. That's when you're in love. Hashem says, I love you. You're in Mitzrayim, I'll be there. Gedol l'chivas anshei Yisrael, shenikol alem HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Look at Rabbi Shimon. B'makom, avodes kochavim. U'v'makom, tinofes. U'v'makom, tuma, b'shvel agol. Where you are, I am. In the parable, it's a well-known parable, if you've never heard the matter of a Kohen, who watches his truma roll into a cemetery, and he says, I have to go in there. It's the last place I should be, but I have to go into the cemetery because my truma's there. Now, why is this important, that this is the night of Gilui Shchina? Well, if it's the night of Gilui Shchina, what do we have to bring to create Gilui Shchina? What do we bring to create Gilui Shchina? A karban. Now, why do we put the blood on the doorposts? Not so Hashem should see the blood. He doesn't need to see it. He knows where we live. The blood was on the inner part of the door, not the outer part of the door, as all these false pictures depict. Why do we put the blood on the doorpost? Because every karban requires zrikas hadam. There's only one problem. They didn't have a mizbeach. This is a good one-liner to our Torah. If your grandfather asked you for one line to our Torah, here it is. Here's the punchline. The Gemara in Pesachim says, source number two, they didn't have a mizbeach, so what did they use for the first mizbeach? Tani Rabbi Yosef, it's a Gemara in Zvachim, in Pesachim, shlosha mizbechot hayusham, ala mashkof yashtem mizizos. The first mizbeach was the Jewish home, Jewish family. They put the blood on the top post and the side post for Zrikas Hadam to bring HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shchina. This is a time of Mara Gadol. Here is the Chiddush, guys. Listen carefully. Maybe you heard it from Rav Meidan or from Yoel Ben Nun. If you hadn't, here's your chance. The word Pesach is also a multi-layered word. But at its core, it does not mean Passover. That word is a myth. What does Pesach mean? Let me explain it to you. Pesach comes from the same etymology as Pesach. What's a Pesach? Lame person. Now everyone look at me, don't look at my legs, look at me. I'm going to simulate the gait of a lame person. I'm going to be obviously very exaggerated. So I'm actually moving forward. It doesn't look that way. Sadly, I saw two of my rebbeim who walked more or less that way. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, it took him an hour to walk maybe from one side of the room to the other after a stroke. I saw Rav Aaron Lichtenstein after his medical complications also, refusing to have any surgery, a wheelchair, just literally taking at certain points an hour to walk from one side of the room to the other. The word Pesach means to hover. A lame person appears to hover because they walk in slow gait, so they seem to be moving in one place. When Eliyahu HaNavi turns to the Nevi HaBaal and wants to, as we would say, dance at two weddings and be duplicious and worship Hashem and also worship, and we say that, Ad matai atem posachim al shtei ha'seifim. He's not saying how long will you skip over or pass over. They're not skipping over. I mean, they want to be on both sides of the fence. They want to be in the firm side, as we would say, serving Hashem, and the adulterous side. And you can't have both, just make a decision. The word Pesach doesn't mean Hashem skipped over the homes. The word Pesach means this was the night of Gilui Shchina. We brought a karban. We put the dam on the mizbeach. Hashem Shchina hovered, enveloped the Jewish home. Now, once Hashem Shchina enveloped the Jewish home, who couldn't get in? Malcham Avos. Read this pasuk. If you don't read Pesach the way I read it, this pasuk makes no sense. Look at source, and I'll prove it to you in a moment. Look at source number chet. V'yavar Hashem l'ngofet Mitzrayim. V'ra'as adam ala mashko v'l'shtem v'zuzav. U'fasach Hashem ala Pesach. He skips over your home, the traditional way. If he skipped over the home, then what does he mean? He's ready to move to the next house. What do you mean? Won't let the mashkin enter. The real way to read the pasuk is Ufasach Hashem ala Pesach. Hashem will envelop the home with his Shechina. Pasach is a hover. Once Hashem is enveloping the home, who can't get in? Malcham Avos. Pesach does not mean Passover. Now it does mean, it means both, because the next morning you woke up and you assessed the landscape, you said death, 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 no death, 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 death. So it appeared there was a skip over. So the appearances were a skip over, Passover. But the methodology was not Passover. Hashem didn't skip over anything. Hashem came and enveloped the home, and the mashkes couldn't enter. So maybe when you go back, who's going back to New Jersey, go to your ShopRite or to your Jewel, run over, pull off the Passover signs, Passover section, and replace them with Hover Over. Because your rabbi and Gersh told you, the real name is Hover Over, not Passover. Okay. Call me from jail and I'll bail you out. Until then I die. And bring your well Seder to jail.
Oh.
Now, I'm not making this up. Look at the matters. This is a Mechilta. This is not me speaking. It's not really all been speaking. This is the Mechilta. So it's over here. I will appear to you. I will hover above you. It can't be any more black and white. Torah says, Ufasachti, I'll be nigger. It's not sure about Yishma. Now again, Pesach means a lot of things. It means hover over, it means skip over, it means compassion, chas, the word Pesach. Try to understand, as you've seen already in Sigil, that words can mean multiple complementary meanings, but the core meaning of Pesach is not skip over, but hover over, and this is the night of Gilui Shechina, the first night, not Shavuot, the first night of Gilui Shechina is in the cemetery of Egypt, right in all these corpse-laden streets of Mitzrayim. Okay, that's part number three. Part number one, Yad Chazaka Zohadev. Part number two, Zohanatiya Zohacher, metaphorical war and actual war. Part number three, Uvra Maragadol Zugi Lishlina. Part number four, this is really complicated, but everyone has to stay for the end because the end is not complicated, but if you don't hear it from me, you will never, ever, ever understand the end of Haggadah. So you got to stay for the end because that, there's only one way to understand it. What's part number four? Otot. How do we interpret Otot? Zamata. How do we know the word Otot in Kitavo means Mata? Hashem delivers the matah to Moshe. In Parashas Shemot, he says, "Vesamata ezat tikach biyadecha asher tasebot otos." If in Shemot the word matah is only with otos, then in Kitavo the word otos is a shout out to matah. Now the question is, who cares about the matah? Why is it important for us to feature the matah as part of Yetzias Mitzrayim? What are we trying to convey by the matah? So three quick ideas. One not so quick. The last two pretty quick. The Rambam has, according to the Rambam at least, has a very novel definition of miracles. We think a miracle is Hashem says, oh, Am Yisrael has to pass through the Yam Suf. Let me barge into nature, tear it apart, and turn water into salt. The Rambam says, no. Every miracle that Am Yisrael would ever need is pre-programmed into nature. So when Hashem created water, he programmed the molecular structure of water to solidify after 2,448 years, a time release. When Hashem set the planets in motion on day four, he set the planets in motion on day four, he set the planetary motion so that 2,488 years of history, approximately, when Yeshua was fighting the Mishnah on Erev Shabbat, needs a little more time, sun stops. Not when it revolves around Israel. The earth revolves around the sun in his Israel. So the sun stops at that moment. Now we think this is a less impressive form. It's not Hashem's full miracle. This is Hashem. But let me teach you a Gemara in Shabbos, and you'll see it from a different angle. Gemara in Shabbos says, okay, source number, Maisa Be'avach Maisa Ishto. Man's wife passes away, and there's a little baby to nurse. And he's poor, and he can't afford to hire a wet nurse. So his baby's starving. So what happens? Hashem creates a miracle where this man begins to lactate. And he nurses his baby. And Rabbi Yosef said, wow. You know, Rabbi Yosef is blind. Wow. This person is an Odom Chashuv. And Abaya says, what, are you crazy? He's a freak. If you're an Odom Chashuv, his wife would have died. A neighbor would have offered to nurse the child. He would have found some money. That's how Hashem takes care of people he loves, turning a man into a lactating nurse. That's how Hashem wants him. What it means is that the Rambam feels that this is a demonstration of how much Hashem loves us. If you come to my house for Shabbos, let's say, And the table was set for my wife and I all last night. Oh, he said, put a pizza, then put a plate there, whatever. I was all like, yeah, you really? If I knew you were coming, I said, I have my kids in shul. But let's say you knew you were coming, you called me up, your two girls in seminary, you called me up, you're coming. Oh, my goodness, put out some plate. It means like you're not important to me. I have other things on my mind. Okay, I'll put out a plate for you. But when you come to the house, your bed is made and your plate is set, and I expected you. So that with everything I had going on in my life, your needs are important to me, and I took care of those needs. Hashem was a very, very busy God the week of Shavuot Shemibri. He had a lot on his mind. He was creating universes and upper worlds. But yet the needs of Am Yisrael throughout history were paramount. And he pre-programmed those needs into history. According to the Rambam. Now, the Mata is the stick within which all those miracles are already pre-downloaded. If you want to imagine the Mata as a USB, and all Moshe has to do is put the USB stick, literally. Put the USB stick. Right? One day someone will be a high tech, he'll make a USB looking like a staff. An ancient herder, a shepherd staff. Put the USB in the computer, all the miracles are there, right? That is why, this is how the Rambam explains, the Mata, amongst all the other objects that perform miracles, very important Mishnah, we read the Mishnah, source number one, Asara Devarim Livru Be'erev Shabbos Be'en Hashmashos. 10 things were created, the Erev Shabbos of creation, Be'en Hashmashos. What were they? So, the Piaretz, the land that would engulf Korach, Pia Be'er, the Be'er Miriam, Pia Aton, the Bilam's donkey, Hakeshet, the rainbow, Haman, the Mun, Hamata. Guys, why are these miracle objects created during Be'en Hashmashos? Make up your mind, Hashem. Either create them during Shesh Yisimei Bereshis, or create them afterwards. Like, what's this halfway, overtime? The answer is... They can't be created during Shesh Yisimei Bereshis proper, because they're not part of the normal functioning of natural law. They're not part of the sun rising every night. They're different, they're deviant. But Hashem wants to create them as part of creation because he wants them to be able to be programmed. So he creates them in this twilight zone between creation and the end of creation. So when we say, so Zamata, I got to tell you, I said, we are important enough to Hashem that all these miracles are created. It's not like you have to, oh, last minute here, I'll come up with something. Hashem was thinking about Yitzias Mitzrayim and Kriyas Yamzuf and Mitzvardea and Dam when he created the world. Second reason the Mata is important, and particularly why it's called Osos. The Medrash says, Hashem tells Moshe, source number Hey, Amalek Kodesh Baruch Hu Matanos Har Beyeshli Litein Al Yadcha. This Mata is not going to be a Mata of Makos, Hashem tells Moshe in Shmos. It's going to be a Mata of Osos, which means in addition to Makos, it's going to deliver Man, it's going to deliver Shabbos, it's going to deliver water. It's going to bring Anan and a covenant for protection. It's going to help you cross the Yamsuf comfortably. Shift, Moshe. Don't call it a Mata of Makos. Call it a Mata of Osos. It happened to include some Makos. Why is this important? Because remember, everyone is first learning about Hashem. And if this is your first encounter with Hashem, Jew or Plishti or whatever, Hammurabi, Babylonian, whatever you are, what are you seeing Hashem as? An angry, violent, vengeful, vileful punisher of the Egyptians. And that's all you saw. And that's not Hashem, right? That's how God is viewed by suicide, Islamic fundamentals. People are happy when innocent people die. We know Hashem is Melech HaRachamim. And we try to be Baalei HaRachamim like HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Melech HaRachamim. Hashem is telling Moshe, it's not a Mata of Makos, it's a Mata of Osos. And one day, it will provide food and water and rest and Mishkan and protection and safe passage. It's an Otot. Right now, it has to provide Mako because I need to release you from slavery. So we say Mata, and we call it Mata, Hotot Zeh Mata, we're reminding ourselves it's not about plagues. Finally, the third reason the Mata is there is to depersonalize Moshe. Remember, people that are vulnerable are very impressionable and they can be easily manipulated. That's part of what's happening in today's world of failed democracies. People are very vulnerable They feel like there's a lot of hostility and violence, and they can't control their world. And that allows populist totalitarian dictators to take control. I vote for so-and-so, and I'm willing to give up my liberty because I need safety, I need security, I need assurance, I need strong-armed tyrants. That's why that happens earlier. Hitler rose to power because the Germans felt so demoralized that we're willing to give up our liberty and our civility in order to restore wounded German pride, wounded Russian pride. So you have these slaves that were just tortured. 200 years. Now Moshe's coming along, miracles and dazzling miracles and drawing the ocean bed and breaking Pharaoh's will. He's going to become a rock star. He's going to become a kol hero. So Hashem is telling Moshe, every miracle you perform, I don't want it to be about you. I want to depersonalize you. The mantra is a way to depersonalize Moshe. Mem Shin Hei becomes Mem Ted Hei. That's why Moshe's name isn't mentioned in the Haggadah. The mantra is a shout out to Moshe indirectly. But listen to Hashem telling Moshe at Har Sinai, the same Medrash, Amalei Kodesh Baruch Hu, source, hey, v'asamata zetikach biyadecha, im eina ta'osa shlichuti, if you don't perform my shlichos, afidu makil zeholech, even a twig, even a little twig can perform miracles. So you imagine Moshe holding the mata, the message is, it's not Moshe. The mata is just a conduit through which Kodesh Baruch Hu's lightning, if you saw the movie, lightning comes flowing through the mata. Okay, that's a little bit pyrotechnic effects, but the mata has that way to simulate that there's something larger than Moshe responsible for the mako. So this is why the mata is so important. A, because it is a pre-programmed miracle. B, because it's not a mata. It's the same mata that throughout Tanakh or throughout the Chumash is going to be responsible for non-plagues, for prosperity and welfare. And also because it depersonalizes Moshe. Okay, summarize, breath, and then the final part. So we've dealt with 80%, but of 25% of the Haggadah. And it's taken us an hour. But this is time better spent than gematrios and white beards. And so when you sit down with it, every time you have, please, even if it's not in the Haggadah, read through the Pesukim, read through the Rishonim, read through the Midrashim. Someone asked me, what's my favorite Haggadah? Favorite Haggadah is Haggadah that has all these Midrashim, and I read the Midrashim, or Haggadah that has the Rishonim. I can hear, what do the Ritva feel about this? What are their rabbi, like? There's stuff here. Learn it like a sugya. Take the time and read into it. Don't fall into lazy, repetitive, what did this one say, what did that one say. Take the time to see what it says. That's right. Okay. Yad Chazak HaZohar. Theological debunking. Zohar Netuni Zohar Cheref. Metaphoric war, actual war. Maragadol Zegila Shechina. The night of Hashem's appearance on Yisrael. First Gila Shechina, Mass Revelation. Vozal Zemata. A lot of different ideas. Here is the most bizarre part of the Haggadah. But here you really aren't paying attention, because in the rest of the Selamat, you're maybe half paying attention. Here you know it's paying attention, because you're busy putting the wine. What's the last word of Parshas Ki Tavo? The last word of the four Pesukim. It's Yishev HaKem Yishev Yechazaka. Zayin Etuya. Uvi Osas. Uvi Mavsim. Last word. Merveh Osas Mavsim. What is that God to interpret Mofsin to me? What? Dam? Why in the world are we going back to Dam? It means this is ridiculous. It's not, because I'll show you the matters this is based upon. And oh, that's what it means, obviously. Ridiculous. Why are we going back to Dam? Why is the last word describing CS and going back to Dam? And not only is that bizarre, but why does Moshe mean Dam? Get ready for this. Because there's a pasuk in Yoel. What? That describes the apocalypse. And the apocalypse has bloody heavens filled with smoke and fire. What is going on here? Ve'asati Moshe b'shamayim u'v'aretz. Dumb bags. Let me take the wine out. I don't know what you're talking about. Let me take the wine out of your cup. Dumb bags. The Timos Hashem. What in the world is going on? What does the Baal HaGadah mean? The word Mofsim means dumb, because in Yoel, when it describes the Messianic apocalypse, there's a heaven that's filled with blood and some smoke and fire. Make sense of that. Okay, everyone listen. This is not an answer. This is the answer.
This is what the Haggadah means. There's no other way to read this. This is the only time I'll ever tell you this. Now, there are other ways to interpret the Pasuk. And Yahweh, the Pasuk, you tell me, that's fine. But if you want to know what the Haggadah wants to tell us, this is exactly what the Haggadah wants to tell us. Listen carefully. Mitzrayim is a template for future Geula. That's why it's called Leil Shimurim. It's a night that's reserved. Everything that happened in Mitzrayim will happen again. The Medrash says this. Not only in general, but if we drill down to the 10 Makos, the Medrash says, and I'll read it with you in a moment, I'll just summarize it with you, that when Mashiach comes, there will be a dumb-like experience. It won't be exactly dumb, but it will resemble dumb, because it will be built on the tzvardeh. And when Mashiach comes, it will be a tzvardeh-like experience. Not exactly tzvardeh from the Nile, but oh, that's like tzvardeh. When Mashiach comes, it will be a kinim-like event. Not exactly kinim, something like kinim. All 10 of the Makos will recur. This is the Medrash. And the Medrash, to prove its point, quotes a pasuk for each Makkah. It'll be a dumb-like experience based on, this is the pasuk about Mashiach. Hashem's will be something like that. There'll be a tzardel-like experience, and it quotes a pasuk from Yeshaya. There'll be a kingdom-like experience. This is the Medrash. Let's just read the Medrash, okay? Together. Rabbi Levi, Vishem, Reb Chana Bar Chanina, Misha, Paramin, Harishon, who's the Paramin, Achronin? Ma Mitzrayim Dam, Avedom Dam. I'm skipping the pasuk. You'll see why. Line number 3. Ma Mitzrayim Tzvardeya, Av Edom Kain. Shenemar, Pasuk in Yeshaya, there'll be a lot of loud noise. Ma Mitzrayim Kinim, Av Edom Kinim, Benevchu, Nachalei, Lezefet, Vafara, Legofrit, Vaitar, Ritzah, Pasuk in Yeshaya. Vayachah, Zefar, Arutz. Ma Mitzrayim Arov, Av Edom Kain, Pasuk in Yeshaya. Ma Mitzrayim Deber, Av Edom Kain, Pasuk in Yecheska. 10 psukim, 10 makos, and 10 messianic events that resemble the makot. Namely, the makot in Mitzrayim were omens that foreshadowed future events. What's the Hebrew word for an omen? Emophes. Emophes is a forerunner of some other event. So the Haggadah tells us the last word, after we finish talking about Mitzrayim, the last word, everything we've talked about, they're going to happen again in the future in thousands of years. Because these are not just one-off events. They're omens. They're mosin. And that God that quotes this medrash. Why are the 10 makos mosin? Because I'll quote all 10 psukim that tell us about these mako-like events that will happen in the future. How was that God doesn't want to quote 10 psukim for us? So what is the quote? The first pasuk. Dam will happen again, and that's why Dam is a mofesh in Nemar, because when we are redeemed, as Yoel describes, there will be Dam-like events in heaven. There will be Dam and smoke. Not there was smoke in Egypt. There will be Dam-like events when we're redeemed. And the Haggadah says, you know what the word that's missing from the Haggadah is? Etc. There's one word missing from the Haggadah. That these events are mountain, and they will recur in history. Dam will recur. Shenamar v'nasati mofsim b'shamayim v'artz dam v'yish v'shim v'sashem. Tzvardeh will occur. It's a mofes also. Shenamar the pasuk in Yeshaya. Kinyum will recur. Pasuk in Yeshaya. Arav will recur. The pasuk in Yechezka. But instead of the Haggadah quoting this huge medrash here and making Dayenu even later and making your mother roll her eyes even more, the Haggadah just quotes the first pasuk that all the makos are moftim. And one example of a makkah being a mofet is the first makkah, dam. Dam happened in Yitzrayim. There'll be a similar event of dam that will happen when Mashiach comes, based on the pasuk of Yoel. There'll be a similar event of tzvardeh. There is no other way to read this. This simply doesn't exist. This is a direct shout out to the Medrash. The first pasuk in the Medrash, and that's why it's called moftim, and that's why it's at the end. They are forerunners of future events. There are other ways to read what the word moftim means. But now God is cluing us in. This is the last word. The last word reminds us everything we've talked about will happen again based on the Medrash. These are the 10 psukim. Medrash, now God is just going to quote one because it assumes you know the Medrash. And it just quotes the first pasuk and refers to the Medrash. Okay, so I hope and I pray that I proved the point to you. This is what happened. How did we leave? What happened that night in Mitzrayim? What does the Cherev mean? What are the macro structure like? This section is where it unfolds. Right here. You can't control your Seder, and this is all good problems. They're not wasting the time talking about the football game. Everyone's not wasting the time. Everyone's taking the time talking about all their enthusiasm to get into the Haggadah. But what happens is it just time flies, and you want to meet the Afikoman time, and everyone's looking at each other, and
you miss it. You miss Agadas, at least on your own. If the Seder is spending too much time on, I don't know, the Machlokas, Ben Zoma, the Chachamim, and Bar Gemara, and Brachas, which we'll learn together in the summers, about Gaitz, about Emirat Hashem, just like spend some time reading this, or spend some time preparing this, because that's what you see, it's yes, this way. Okay? Those who are going to Poland, say Shem Lashalom. No other way to read that. Can you see the message? How else would you? Again, because I did it. Everyone's too busy. Down, but everyone's Asha. And the woman said, Asha, why are we going back to Down? What does he all have to do with this? Okay, everyone look at yourself. There's no other chug now, right?